that does not abrogate what the New Testament says about this, and I see no reason to try to get around this just to justify what we have done. There were individuals who did it, as if I read this verse correctly. Now he says here, let all things be done unto edifying. Let everything that's done be to the upbuilding of the church. If it's not to the upbuilding of the church, if it's to the tearing down of the church, then we've got to change something. Verse 27, if any man speak in an unknown tongue, let it be by two, or at the most by three, and that by course, and let one interpret. By course meaning in part or by rotation. And he may mean here just two or three tongue speakers involved in a given assembly of the church, because this was not the most important of the gifts, and it could get old in a hurry. So two or three, perhaps two or three people is what he's referring to here. But if there be no interpreter, then let him keep silence in the church. Let him speak to himself and to God. Let the prophet speak two or three, and let the other judge. Now, this two or three, I believe, means more than two or three prophets. He means something different than that. Because down in verse 31, he definitely says, you may all prophesy one by one, that all may learn and that all may be comforted. You know that the whole tenor of Paul's remarks in this chapter has been toward prophecy and away from tongue speaking, where the assembly was concerned. And so he says here, you may all prophesy one by one. Then why does he say, let the prophet speak two or three in verse 29? I believe he's talking here about the way the prophet operated. Let a prophet speak two or three sentences, a paragraph of thought, and then let the other discerner of spirits judge. Then you pause, and the discerner of spirits judges this. I don't know how long it took. I suppose that he could judge it immediately, whether or not it was the Spirit of God. And he would nod his head then, and then you'd speak two or three sentences more. But there was a tight connection here between these two. You didn't. I don't believe you delivered a whole 30-minute speech, and then the prophet either said yes or no, or the discerner either said yes or no. I think this was as he was going along that this judgment was made. That's why he would speak two or three sentences, as I view it, and let the other judge. The word for judge means discern. And here's an interesting thing. Marvin, go ahead.
That would certainly limit you from developing a very complicated thought.
Right.
If he had to be approved every two sentences, we'd be much more careful about our speech.
That's right. And
maybe that's a safeguard, Bill.
I think it was. I think that would be very interesting, because doesn't it happen among us that we'll start out by saying it might have been this way, and then a few minutes later into our talk, the assumption is that that's the way it was. And by the time we get to the end, there's no question whatsoever, and there's no other way to see it. We can see this happening among ourselves. Carter?
Wouldn't the same procedure apply with the interpreters?
Yes, I think it would. I don't think that they could speak more than two or three sentences. And that may be what it means up there in verse 27.
But not for the same reason.
No, not for the same reason. And also, the thing that about verse 27 that makes it a little bit different for me is that he says they're in part or by rotation. By rotation would seem to indicate that two or three tongue speakers would rotate in turn. But I'm right with you on the idea that they wouldn't speak very much before it was interpreted. Just as today in the United Nations or somewhere else, when one of the leaders of China was over here not too long ago, he would speak two or three sentences and then the interpreter would translate. That's the way it's done. Yes?
I think one of the things that the propagandist does is to start by getting you to agree to something and then taking you off on a tangent. I'm sure the devil does that, and I know propagandists in the world do that. They like to start by getting you to agree with something. So if you follow them long enough, it's pretty hard to trace your way back.
That's true. That's right. And that's one great thing about the way we are operating here and in all such similar discussions, is that anybody has the right to break in at any time and question any point, so that we're not as likely to get too far gone. Not as likely. Tom? of prophecy? Because down in verse 31 he says, you may all prophesy one by one. And that is so clear-cut that I'm assuming that all the prophets could speak during the same assembly, one by one. Because then he says, if something is revealed to somebody who sits by, let the other person finish, and then let that one go.
And like you said, the rotation in turn is here, but it isn't here with the prophets.
No, that's why I think the two or three may mean different things. Two or three tongue speakers, and then two or three sentences during an individual prophecy at a time.
Could be sentences or thoughts.
Well, either way, I don't really know.
I would hear you talking in paragraphs, but a sentence wouldn't really get you very far.
No. Although if you were the Apostle Paul, some of his sentences would get you quite a way. Mark, I think you were next.
Prophecy, we are using it, addressing it, and we're pretty much all familiar with what it is, but to what advantage and what would they actually prophesy? What would these people say in a given group, and they were called upon and they prophesied? What kind of things would they say?
Okay, what kind of things would the prophets say? I believe they would say the same kinds of things that we have recorded in the New Testament scriptures. We're so used to having them that it's difficult to think of what it would be like, not only if we didn't have them, but if we had never seen them. The prophets would be giving information which you and I are already pretty familiar with. Now, there would be some that we wouldn't be, some that would deal with the local situation that we didn't need. But they would be giving the same kind of information that Paul gave to the Galatians when he wrote it down, or to the Romans when he wrote it down, or to the Corinthians when he wrote it down. That same kind of information. I think it would sound like the New Testament sounds. Mark?
I think we have to remember, too, that the people in their audience, some of them were slaves. They'd never been to school a day in their life. And they had to understand just as well as Paul did, who sat at the feet of Gamaliel.
That's right.
Some people can comprehend the whole paragraph if they listen to it, but very few. Even of us today who have all been to school, if the man gave a whole paragraph at one time and wasn't going to repeat it, we'd have a hard time recalling it.
Right. Especially if we weren't so familiar with what's in here already.
This is all new material.
Right.
Like listen to the atomic bomb explanation.
Right. Did you hear that? Okay, good. Lewis?
In 1 John, the 4th chapter, is an indication that the method of discerning spirits had changed by the time this book was written. As it says in verse 6, we are of God. He who knows God hears us. And he who is not of God does not hear us. By this we know the spirit of truth and the spirit of error. The apostles' teaching apparently at this time was established thoroughly enough that it could be used as a standard rather than a supernatural nodding of the head or disavowing.
Yes, this change was gradually taking place. 1 John was written very late. 1 John, 2 John, 3 John, and Revelation were all written comparatively late, as far as we know. It's true. No?
There's a passage in the second verse that seems to give albeit in the spirit, he's speaking of mysteries. We throw our whole argument about enlightenment out with that one, I'm afraid. How would you comment on that?
Well, to me, the only reason they were mysteries is because nobody understood them.
What verse?
Verse 2. Howbeit in the spirit, he speaketh mysteries. If I was standing here talking German, it would be a mystery to you unless you happen to understand German. But once it was translated, it would be as clear as day. So that was the only thing mysterious about it. I don't look at there being any ethereal quality about this, super spiritual quality.
But the Pentecostals believe that.
Yes, oh yes.
Well, it could be a mystery from that standpoint also. When speaking of mysteries of faith, not just speaking about something that can't be comprehended, but something that we understand and remember with us.
Right. The word mystery in the New Testament just means that which has not been revealed. We are part of the fellowship of the mystery, but the apostles and prophets were given to make all men see what is the fellowship of the mystery, so it no longer needs to be a mystery to us. Good question. Carter, did you have your hand up?
You just took the words out of my mouth. I'd just like to add
prophesy or this gift is through Mr. Denver includes teaching by divine inspiration, not exclusive to, not exclusive to the forthcoming future events.
Right. That's true. And the switch that was taking place here, as Lewis was mentioning there in 1 John 4, is further amplified by something that Peter said when he made the statement, as there were false prophets among them, so shall there be false teachers among you. So he doesn't say there will be false prophets among you, because this concept of prophecy was already passing away. So they're using prophecy on the one side and teaching on the other side. That, incidentally, is the only place in the New Testament where the expression false teacher is used. Pseudo-didaskalos. Only place. Mark.
First, back up to Moen and said here, concerning the tongues, and yet no tongues, and back in comments concerning some of those who believe and ability. It makes a comment here in verse 3 that he is to keep it to himself, that some of the other terms that he is able to do this. Now, the knowledge of what he said, the person who was speaking in the tongues, did he know what he was saying?
No.
Okay.
Not as I view it. The tongue speaker had no idea what he was saying. If he did, he could interpret it himself. And why would he need an interpreter to tell us what it meant?
Then what would be the gain in doing it?
Well, that's what Paul said. You know, why is it such a big deal to you people? There are other gifts that are better. Martin?
I think the gain of doing it, though, is that it doesn't give all the power to one man. I can see God's wisdom in separating the two, because if I could speak in tongues and then interpret it, that sounds like a collusion. Yeah, you got off in your closet and figured this all out. I'm going to say gobbledygook here, and then I'll tell you what it means.
Uh-huh.
That couldn't happen.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear you. Tom?
Can you comment on the reason that Paul talks about tongues?
Louder, Tom.
Okay. Verse 21 and 22. Comment on that.
Okay, verse 21 and 22. In the law it is written, with men of other tongues and other lips will I speak unto this people, and yet for all that will they not hear me, saith the Lord. Wherefore tongues are for a sign, not to them that believe, but to them that believe not. But prophecy serveth not for them that believe not, but for them that which believe. He's pointing out there, I think, the relative difference between these two. The tongues were generally to be used in order to influence the unbeliever. They were for a sign to the unbeliever. It started on the day of Pentecost. The tongues on the day of Pentecost were not for the preaching of the gospel, but they were for a sign. The tongues were the drawing card on that occasion. They were the window dressing to get you into the store. And so once the crowd was gathered, because these people were speaking in all these languages that they previously had not studied, and the crowd couldn't explain it, how hear we every man speak in our own language wherein we were born? Then it was Peter who stood up and preached the gospel in Hebrew, I believe, and not in language that he hadn't studied. He preached the gospel. People were never saved by miracles. They were always and only saved by the gospel. So that's what he means there, I think, when he says it's for a sign, not to them that believe, but to them that believe not. At the household of Cornelius, they were assigned to the Jews who didn't believe that the Gentiles would ever be let in.
And it wasn't like other things that it had twofold purpose. It would help those who had an honest heart, and it would cause those who didn't want to believe to stumble. Is that what you get from this? By the fact it says, but even then they will not listen to
me. Yeah. I don't think that it was intended to make them stumble, but it forced them to an issue against which they had to make a decision. There was a hand back there. Richard?
That also points out the difference between, as I'm speaking of, the New Testament and the current tongue speaking, because one of the main reasons why we're talking speaking is because we're truly speaking
Yes.
And so it's for the believers in this case, the modern case, although Paul plainly says here that it's just the opposite for the unbelievers. So
Jake?
Why would the gift of tongues be used in the assembly?
Well, there evidently was some benefit to it. It was a limited and lesser benefit than that of prophecy. But there was still some benefit to it. Evidently, there were some things revealed in this way that would be helpful. Marvin?
My third verse says that there were people there that were unbelievers.
Right.
So, in every assembly, there were undoubtedly people who were curious. There were people who were in doubt as to whether they're going to believe this new doctrine. And I can see where the early church in Corinth would have had as maybe as many unbelievers as they had believers in the assembly.
Okay. Yeah, that's true. There were unbelievers there, but the assembly was primarily for the believers and not for the unbelievers. And in many instances, this is what we have to decide today. Are our assemblies for the church? Is the assembly of the church for the church, or is it for the unbeliever and to try to influence the unbeliever during the assembly of the church? I think we can take some clues from the emphasis that Paul puts on it here, that he limited the tongue speaking and encouraged the prophecy. There was another hand back there somewhere, I thought. Okay. Carter?
I don't know what this is, but I have marginal notes on this word unlearned here in verse 23. Word and Mayer's comment, in this verse, one who is both not a prophet, destitute to the gift of tongues, unquote.
Okay, thank you. Ann?
Your services were not geared for both. How would you teach the children just at home?
Well, the primary place for the teaching of the children is at home, although we...
Well, but I'm saying it would need to be for both, because you
sure.
have unbelievers constantly, I would think.
Yeah. And I think we gear our assemblies depending on who's there, rather than just set a course of something that we're going to do and plow through it, whether or not it's applicable to the ones who show up.
I didn't mean that they shouldn't be taught home.
I understand that.
Have it coordinated.
Yeah, good point. Steve.
Wouldn't you say that the people here that are being described as unbelievers would be those that were there for some reason of searching out either to prove Christianity wrong or to find out if it's right.
Mm-hmm.
And possibly with these tongues, since they could say if these people are out of their minds, then if they would hang around for a few minutes longer and listen to the prophesying, then they would hear it expounded upon and then they'd come to a conclusion.
Yes, that's exactly what Paul says there a little bit further down. Very good. There was one more hand on this, I thought. Oh, was it yours, Tom? Okay.
On the verse, let him pray that he may interpret. Some use that to say that you can pray for spiritual gifts. What would you say on that verse?
Oh, there's no question in my mind about what you can pray for spiritual gifts. I just don't think you can get them. Certainly. And on that same point, Paul says... forbid not to speak in tongues. Well, I don't forbid anybody to speak in tongues. I just don't think they can. If they've got the ability, I'd be happy for them to exercise it. But it's kind of begging the question, because that's really the very point at issue. It's interesting to me that there seems to be this great interest still maintained in this subject, because it's been discussed so much through the years, and I had thought that maybe it was beginning to die down some, but there's still a lot of intrigue about this. And for those of you who are... Go ahead, Ann. Well, I was just going to say, for those of you who are interested in this subject, I think you would do well to pick up that little book I mentioned yesterday, The Psychology of Speaking in Tongues, by John P. Kildall. And there's another one, too, since you manifest this great interest, that you might be interested in looking at. It's called Tongues to Speak or Not to Speak, by Donald W. Burdick. I brought that along, in fact... And I think I'll just read you a little statement from this book.
What is
about
his name again?
Burdick, B-U-R-D-I-C-K, Donald W. Burdick, A Contemporary Analysis of Glossolalia. Tongues to Speak or Not to Speak is the name of the book. When he gets into the section of the book where he's attempting to explain why we see this phenomenon crop up again and again and again historically, he has this to say, and I'm not going to read very much, but I think this is worth looking at. tongues experience then, and he's talking about the modern day so-called tongues experience, is the ability to regress to the point where the person can voice his feelings without any conflict between love and hatred. In other words, you're talking, but you're not saying anything. You're simply releasing your emotions. This means that the glossolalic has been able to return psychologically to that infantile stage prior to the beginning of the conflict of love and hatred toward the parent. The tongue speaker is one who has a sense of inner conflict which is above average in intensity. Read another statement here. The glossolalic, first of all, is apt to be a person who is so constructed psychologically that he is susceptible to the tongue's experience. In many instances, this psychological preparation seems to be provided in part by home problem, by problem home situations, which produce a marked feeling of insecurity, as well as difficulty in maintaining satisfying interpersonal relationships. And I mention these things not to embarrass anyone who might be here and who claims this gift. As far as I know, there are none of you, but there may be. But I mention this because I think it, if we examine this and look into it, it helps us to understand those with whom we come in contact who claim this gift. Quite often they are from very unstable backgrounds, from extreme crises situations, and they're in an agonizing inner struggle and turmoil, and they just feel like they've got to know whether God really lives. And in the middle of all that, they'll get involved with somebody who's already involved in this, and pretty soon they're speaking in tongues too. I think we can explain it sociologically and psychologically. Marvin?
Don't you believe also that we all have a desire to want more than we have, and that we all have a desire to get back to the original because that was the ideal, supposedly. But really, it wasn't the ideal in this case.
Right.
We have the ideal in this case, and we're trading in for something that you have to have a crutch to work with.
Yeah. I show unto you a more excellent way. Ann.
And I was wanting to know, there is a difference, though, in just speaking in a different language, like we might have someone speaking in German and interpreting it, or us being in another land, such as Israel, where they had different languages and mm-hmm. someone to interpret. But that is that different than what we're talking about here of a revelation.
Oh, yes. Sure. The difference is that they were talking in languages that they hadn't studied before, or they hadn't heard before.
No, that isn't what I mean.
You mean the content of it? What they were saying?
Somewhat. I was thinking more in terms of, since they didn't even know themselves the meaning, perhaps, of what they were saying, that would be different than someone speaking in a language that they were expressing
thought. That's true.
They did understand.
Right. When we talk in a language today, no matter what the language is, we know what we're saying. But they didn't know what they were saying when they talked in these languages. It's true. Jay.
Yes, it seems rather interesting. Today, though, if we were in the same situation, we would not need to get the tongues because we have machinery.
Okay.
At the UN, they just speak into a machine and it changes it to whatever language you want to hear.
Okay. Tom?
I think Marvin's point is good, that we ought to appreciate what the charismatics are interested in. Many of them are interested in a good thing. And yet the Corinthians give us an interesting example here. The people who believe in these gifts today would have us believe that this is a sign of spirituality, and this means you're close to God if you have spiritual gifts. Yet the Corinthians were described as carnal,
mm-hmm.
and yet they abounded in spiritual gifts. The
right.
spiritual gifts didn't mean they were mature.
Mm-hmm.
They were merely a sign that God was with them and that what they believed was right.
That's so true. And this is why communication is so important. This is usually the first thing that happens in a congregation where somebody begins to claim the gift of tongues and begin to influence other people toward this, is that there is a breakdown in communication immediately. And this was hinted at, this type of thing was hinted at yesterday in one of the classes where we were talking about people having Bible studies in their homes with with two or three couples and whether the elders should know about it and all that type of thing. Really, it's a matter of communication and love. And this is why this kind of thing shouldn't be driven underground. It ought to be expressed and understood and communicated about. Because if you drive this type of thing underground and it begins to feel persecuted, then it will just multiply all the more. It becomes a gopher that will tear up the whole backyard. It needs to be, there ought not to be anything that we can't communicate with one another about. And the more we can communicate, the opener we can be, the less likely we'll have these walls growing up and have one group of people feeling super spiritual and the other just being on the outside of that. Anybody else? Tom?
I talked to a member of the church one time whose wife was involved with the charismatic movement. He went with her one time to a meeting. It was full of this type of thinking. The preacher says, how many of you have been baptized in the Holy Spirit? Rightfully, everybody raised their hand. But this member, he doesn't raise his hand. The preacher asks him, why haven't you been baptized in the Holy Spirit? And the man says, well, I haven't been baptized in, but I believe I have. The preacher says, oh, so what makes you think you have the Holy Spirit? And the member says, well, the fact that I love you is a sign I have the Holy Spirit.
The Spirit is love. Yeah, this brings about some very interesting encounters. And sometimes it occurs that people feel there should be something more, but really they haven't given the revelation of God that we have in the New Testament a chance. They haven't invested themselves and their time in it so that it can invest them with the benefits that it has. And quite often the attempt to seek the spiritual gifts is like a shortcut. It's a shortcut to get to some spiritual attainment that you want to get to, but you're not willing to go through the work, and so you try to make a shortcut. I'll never forget one time as a child that I had a Bible. It happened to be a Thompson Chain Reference Bible. And one of my friends about my same age said, well, that must be the difference. If I could just have a Bible like yours, I bet I could quote memory verses the way you do, you know, in class. And this is the type of thinking that we get involved in. I think a lot of us have done this with various translations of the Bible. Nobody is more interested in the translation of the Bible and in investigating what God has said in different translations than I am. But still, I think people have tried to use these as a shortcut to get to where they want to go. And it just doesn't work that way. Okay. Tom telling stories here makes me want to tell all kinds of stories about this, but I guess I better not do that. Marvin?
I'd like for you to comment on the gifts that we have today, not miraculous gifts. How we can avoid what was happening at Corinth. How do you feel that you can avoid, if a person has a gift, of not being envious of that gift, or if he has it, how can he avoid it himself of not being big-headed and swelled up about it? I believe we have gifts differing, and
sure.
I believe God gave them to us. I'd like to hear your comment on that, because you are, I think you're gifted in one way, other people are gifted
only one
in
way.
Another way.
Gifted in one way, right. Okay, that's an excellent practical question. How do we avoid being envious of other people? I think the way we do it is by taking the gifts that we've got and pouring ourselves into developing them, whatever they are. And if we exhaust ourselves and consume ourselves and we spend and are spent toward that end, then we're not going to have time to look at what somebody else has and say, we might say, I wish I had that kind of ability. But that's not what you're talking about, I think. We're not going to feel badly toward them. We're going to be glad they've got what they've got. To me, there's a lot more satisfaction in developing what I've got and using it to its peak than there would be in having a lot and just developing a part of it or something. So it's up to us. Tom?
I think the answer to that is thinking of the church as a body.
Right.
And I'm not competing with you or with Richard or Marvin. We're all in this together.
Sure.
We're each contributing what we're capable of doing. It's not a matter of...